good evening. You're listening to The Truth Tank, and I'm your host, The Tank. If this is your first time listening to The Truth Tank, a big welcome. If you're a repeat listener, welcome back. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all the listeners out there. By the time you're hearing this, Christmas and New Year is probably well and truly past, but a happy and festive season nonetheless. I've got a lot of episodes recorded. I'm just editing my way through them. It's taking a lot longer than I'd like. I'm making my way through them as quickly as possible. Avatar Part 2 was the last one I released. Then this one, and I've got another 3, 4, maybe 5 episodes of the Nostradamus one still to come. And then we can get into the gigantic gargantuan The Lie of Communism that will be finally ready to start recording early-ish into the new year. I'm hoping around March, April, somewhere like that. I'm still writing it. I'm about 120 pages in so far. Doesn't ever want to end. The research just keeps going, and I'm at the point I'm having to cut stuff out because I think it's just too weighed down with too much detail, if you can have such a thing. So this episode is more or less another buying time until that is ready episode. However, in saying that, it will be a good episode because we're going to be looking at one of my favorite cinematic characters, and that is none other than the legend himself, Godzilla. We'll be having a look at the latest installment of the Godzilla franchise, and that is Godzilla Minus One. But me being the detail-obsessed person that I am, we'll be digging deeper than just a film review. We're also going to have a look at some of the real-life events that helped inspire everyone's favorite movie monster. Some of them are surprising and hard to believe. That's probably not what you're thinking. That's all I'm going to say. If you want to know the answer to that, you're just going to have to listen. We'll also be having a look at some of the inspirations and backstory to the franchise and more. Without further ado, let's get into tonight's episode. This is episode 53, Godzilla Minus One.
How you going, everyone? I'm Danny Boy. I'm the host of one of Australia's favourite horror podcasts, the Creepy Crap Podcast. The show is quick, it's simple, and it's Australian. The show covers a wide range of horror movies, from the good to the bad, the new to the old, and every second episode is an Australian movie, whether it be horror, exploitation, or something else. The podcast has got it all. And if you want to follow it, you can get it at TikTok, Instagram, Discord, and YouTube. You can get it all at one word at The Creepy Crap Podcast. I'm even on Letterboxd at Creepy Crap Pod. The show is on all the major podcast apps, so if you feel like showing some love, if you're willing, I'd love a 5-star review, but no pressure. I don't know what else to say, but thanks for listening to me. Hope you check out the podcast. It's The Creepy Crap Podcast. Anyway, have a good bloody day. See you later.
So Godzilla Minus One has been pretty hyped. It's been called the action blockbuster of 2023. A lot of the hype surrounds the visual effects and the budget of the film. It cost just under $15 million to make, which is nothing in terms of today's modern blockbusters. It seems every Marvel or Disney film that comes out is like $250, $280 million now, and most of them suck. So to have a big action film that is very special effects heavy to come in at under $15 million and compete with bigger Marvel and Disney titles, but not only just compete, blow them away in every aspect of storytelling and visual effects, is pretty fucking remarkable, especially in 2023. It's hard to believe that everyone's favorite gigantic monster has been around for nearly 70 years. It predates franchises like James Bond, Star Wars, and Star Trek. Bond was the early 60s, I'm pretty sure. Star Trek was mid-late 60s, and Star Wars was the late 70s, making Toho Co.'s Godzilla predate them all. First up, let's look at the latest installment in the Godzilla franchise, Godzilla Minus One. Now, Godzilla Minus One is a Japanese production, and kind of goes without saying that it's all in Japanese. It's the first subtitled film I think I've seen in the cinema. I don't think I've seen any other subtitled films or this heavily subtitled film. It's definitely the first Japanese film I've seen in the cinema. And it wasn't really that bad. After the first 10 minutes or so, you don't really notice the subtitles. The action didn't move fast enough that you missed a whole lot of lines. I think there's only a couple of lines in the entire movie that I couldn't read quick enough or didn't fully take in. Because some subtitled movies jump around too much, especially if they are very action-orientated. And it can be very hard to keep up. So first off, I love the time period it was set in. It's set in post-war Japan, in the years from about, I think, 1945 to 1948 or 1947. Me being a history buff, I found that very interesting. You don't see a lot of films in post-war Japan. Post-war Japan wasn't a very pleasant place. The suburbs outside of Tokyo are pretty much just slums and shanty towns. Times were pretty tough. There's a lack of food, jobs, state security, or any type of government help. And this is the time period the story is set. The cinematography in this film really does help to get that point across. It's a very well shot film. It has this cool kind of retro, action-y kind of cinematography to it. It might just be Japanese action films, they might all look like that. But I did notice that right from the first couple of frames, and this is a spoiler. When the plane's flying over the ocean, it definitely has that war action film kind of look to it. Another thing I really liked was the music. They used the old Godzilla score in some of the action scenes, which is really fucking cool. Combining that with the newer music, it's just a really well crafted and heartfelt reboot of the Godzilla franchise. I'm not sure if it was a reboot, but it kind of kickstarts the series again. I think the first film takes place in post-war Japan or Japan in the 1950s, same type of time period. One of the biggest draw cards of the film, and one that was really surprising, was the quality of acting. At its core, Godzilla Minus One is a story about human beings struggling to survive in the post-war years in Japan. It just also happens to have a gigantic lizard monster that is hell-bent on destroying the Japanese mainland. The human story is the main focal point of the story. Unlike a lot of modern-day blockbusters, it's all about the action and visual effects and how much destruction you can cause on screen. This takes the complete opposite approach. It's all about the humans and their journey through the movie, through life and poverty-stricken slums of Tokyo, and their fight for survival in the slums of Japan and against Godzilla. It's similar in pacing to the 2014 Godzilla. It is better than the 2014 Godzilla. I did like Gareth Edwards' take on it, and it's a good way to kickstart the MonsterVerse, even though the other films that came after were more action, humor focused. The first Godzilla does take itself very seriously, the 2014 one, where Godzilla King of Monsters is more of a gigantic epic action film. Godzilla vs. Kong, more of the same. I liked all of them. They're all good in their own way. But this is kind of similar in the sense that Godzilla is and isn't the main focus of the story. In the 2014 Godzilla, Godzilla is kind of like a secondary character. There's huge chunks of the film he doesn't appear in, and it's like, what, 50-something minutes before you even see him. The Muto is more of the focus of the action. Godzilla kind of comes into it pursuing the Muto creature. Much the same way the Elvis movie isn't so much about Elvis, and it's more about Elvis through the eyes of his manager, Tom Parker. Similar to that, or maybe I'm just completely rambling absolute shit. Either way, I thought it was a pretty original story. It's one you don't see a lot of in the modern-day blockbuster. It definitely had an old kind of feel about it, very much more grounded. And it was very different to the typical Hollywood action story. The main character is a failed kamikaze pilot. He returns to Japan after the war and finds a young woman living on the streets with a baby. The baby isn't hers. They end up moving in together and living together, helping one another out. With help from the eccentric neighbor who has raised children before, she provides much of the comedy in the film. It is a very complex human story. It touches on a lot of different themes that are very relevant today, PTSD being one of them. The main character suffers a lot of PTSD from his time in the war, as do a lot of the other characters that have served. It also gave you a glimpse into post-war Japan and some of the thoughts and feelings of the soldiers who served in the Japanese Army or Navy. Being a Westerner, a lot of World War II movies involving Japan are pretty one-sided, apart from Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima. You always see the Japanese as the bad guys and not so much human beings, and that was a very different time back then. But there's some points some of the characters make. Like, some of them are just fighting for their country, others don't have much else to do. They all have a different take on war. They all fight their own war in a way, which is very unique to see, because you don't see a lot of that from the Japanese side point of view. And I haven't seen very many World War II movies from Japanese filmmakers. And I don't think there's a lot of Japanese World War II films made. A majority of them, I'd say, are pretty much all from the Western point of view. So that was very interesting. One of the other characters is a naval weapons designer. There's a lot of military background to most of the main characters that really make them feel real and authentic. The main character is Koichi Shishkin or something like that. I'm fucking terrible at names. I'm not going to even try to pronounce some of the others. You'll have to look that up yourself. In order to survive, he takes a government-paying job. It's a dangerous job. The woman he lives with is a bit hesitant about it. She thinks this is going to be just like the war, that he's going to put his life on the line for a delusional government. And that's mentioned several times in the film, the lack of governmental care or oversight. The government doesn't really seem to care. They cover a lot of shit up, including Godzilla. And they try to keep the citizens blind to what's going on, which was interesting. And this is not just something that happens in the US or Europe. This is something that happens all over the world with governments. And that was a really cool thing to see, that post-war Japan, the common people don't trust the government. They lie to them, getting them into a war, and they're lying to them with Godzilla and everything else that's happening. There's food rationing going on. Everyone's struggling to survive, which leads the main character, Koichi, to take a job for the government, clearing sea mines left over from World War II. The woman he's living with doesn't want him to go because she thinks he's going to get killed, but it pays 3,000 yen in advance, which is a lot of money back then, and money that was desperately needed, especially with the baby. So he takes the job. We're introduced to the motley crew he's serving with on the ship. It's a small, ratty old wooden boat. We're introduced to the captain of the boat, who's a gruff sea veteran. The young guy who was too young for the war but wishes he served. The smart older guy who served in the Navy as a weapons designer. And the ex-kamikaze pilot. They're a ragtag motley group, but each one of them has unique character traits that come into play further in the story. The young kid who wished he was old enough to serve in the war was a little bit of a cliche character, but done in an original way. If it was a Western film, it probably would have been very cut and paste from other action war type of movies. But here, he's this young, naive kid that doesn't really mean any harm, but always manages to put his foot in his mouth. So what follows next is probably one of the coolest scenes in the entire film, and that is the sea mine chase. Godzilla appears. This is the first time we've seen him for quite a while, since really the opening of the film. So there's a bit of anticipation to see a larger and fully grown Godzilla. He attacks a Navy ship, then turns his attention to the sea mine clearing boat. Koichi and co. look on in shock and awe as he emerges from the water and trashes a Navy boat. And that's what I really love about Godzilla in this too. There's no motivation for him to destroy anything. He more or less appears and just destroys stuff, unlike some of the Hollywood ones where he has to have this motivation or a reason for him being there. In Minus One, he just appears, he's pissed off, and he takes his anger out on whatever is in front of him. So he destroys a Navy vessel, then turns his attention to the sea mine-clearing boat. This is one of the coolest scenes. His head is above the water and he's chasing the boat. The boat's struggling to keep up, and there's this giant Godzilla head chomping right behind the boat, trying to get to the crew. They slow him down with a few sea mines, which buys him enough time to retreat to safety. It's about at this point in the film where we're filled into a bit of the backstory going on between the US and Soviet governments. The US can't intervene and help out Japan with the Godzilla problem because it might look like an act of aggression to the Soviets and trigger another war. And this is before the Cold War. So this fits in with the history. There was a lot of tension between the US and Soviet governments after World War II, mainly concerning the development and testing of nuclear weapons, which is really cool because it grounded this film in historical fact and in reality a bit more. There was a bit more backstory that went into it. It's also about this time that we see Shinza progress. The slums of World War II have been built into suburbs. The city has grown. Life is returning and things are starting to prosper again. The woman living with Kochi, Noriko, she gets a job in an office in downtown Ginza. So the city and suburbs have grown. Things are progressing, but the threat of Godzilla is still looming. And I love what this film does. It gives you pretty decent breaks in between Godzilla appearances. Sometimes it's maybe 20 or 30 minutes before you actually see Godzilla, but probably not 30 minutes, probably more like 20 minutes before you see him again, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Godzilla versus Kong and Godzilla King of the Monsters probably overused Godzilla a little bit, because when you wait to see him and then he appears, a little bit of the shock and awe factor is kind of taken away, especially with Godzilla versus Kong. There's not a huge amount of build-up before you see Godzilla again. Kong, I think, is pretty much in it from the start. I haven't seen the movie in a couple of years. I've got to watch it before the second one comes out. But I can remember there's probably about 20 minutes or so before Godzilla is seen. And once he is seen, a bit of the shock and awe is taken away. Where in Minus One, they retain that shock and awe. Because the first time you see him, he's a young Godzilla. Second time you see him, he's fully grown. And then you want to see him again because you kind of haven't seen him out of the water. And there's a bit more time between that and then obviously to the climax of the film. So it really makes you wait and anticipate the next appearance of Godzilla, which I really liked. So fast forwarding a bit, Godzilla reappears and sets his sights firmly on the city of Ginza. And once again, there's not a lot of motivation. Ginza's just in his way and it's going to feel the full wrath and force of Godzilla. He comes out of the water and levels most of the city. There's a lot of throwbacks and little nods to the original Godzillas, one of which being the score, which I loved. They use the original Godzilla theme and it works perfectly. There's a couple of camera guys and a news reporter on a roof filming the destruction, and it's just that typical over-the-top Japanese Godzilla style. They're amazed at seeing this gigantic monster destroying their city. They're describing it all play out. Godzilla walks past the building and for no reason just decides to hip and shoulder the Grand Imperial Theater, or whatever it was called. Godzilla used to destroy buildings like that all the time in the original films. He just hip and shoulder a building for no reason. And it was very reminiscent of the original Godzilla where a guy in a suit played him. It was a nice little nostalgic touch that I think Godzilla fans will probably get a kick out of. He unleashes his nuclear fire breath and destroys some tanks and more or less nukes a suburb of Ginza. There's a very strong anti-nuke message here, which is one I think the world really needs to pay attention to now, because we're kind of in a second Cold War. The Russians and Americans have their nukes pointed at each other again. Well, they probably never stopped, but it's a bit more prevalent with everything that's been happening in the last 2 years. So much for the peaceful decade. But Godzilla Minus One makes it very clear that nukes are bad. It takes a very strong stance on nuclear disarmament, and it's another background theme of the film. Well, it's a very main theme of the film, but it's not annoying or shoved in your face like a lot of films tend to do these days with their political messaging. It's not very subtle, and it's not really woven into the fabric of the story. It's more just shoved in your face, and it's Hollywood, quote-unquote, telling the average person that they're wrong and they're to blame for all of the world's problems. This takes a very much more subtle approach to getting this messaging across. They also bring up PTSD, which I was a little surprised about, because this is a Godzilla film that touches on a lot of human issues and emotions and very current themes today. They mention PTSD in the Japanese soldiers who have returned, which is something you do not hear or see a lot about, especially coming from Western media in movies or TV shows about World War II. During the attack on Ginza, Noriko is on a train going to work. And at this point, she's been a bit skeptical of Godzilla. She kind of thinks it's more of a PTSD fantasy than anything. So when Godzilla attacks Ginza, she gets a first-hand account of what Kochi was talking about all along. There's an awesome scene where she's on the train and she's looking out the window and you can see the reflection of Godzilla, which is something that's been used in Godzilla films and monster movies before, the reflection in the glass of the big bad monster headed towards you. And when Godzilla picks up the train with Noriko in it, it has that old monster movie trope where one end of the train is being bitten off and Noriko is hanging on for dear life by the railing. She lets go into the water just before the train comes hurtling into the water straight after her. The attack on Ginza is a very impressive sequence, and it's even more impressive when it's when you consider that it only cost like, what, $15 million to make. If that was a Hollywood film, that scene alone would have probably cost $50 million. There's a nice blend of visual effects and practical effects. Minus One also touches on the importance of dreams and the spiritual side of things, which I was really surprised about. There's a lot of themes in this movie that come a little left of field sometimes. It all fits the story and the time period, and dreams and the spiritual, supernatural side of things doesn't get mentioned a lot in Hollywood films, not Hollywood films relating to giant monsters or war veterans with PTSD. I mean, it's reserved for horror films and things like that, but it doesn't really enter the action genre all that much. Now, off the top of my head, the only other movie I can think that really touches on dreams is Dune. I can't wait for Dune 2, which is out next week at time of recording. Cannot fucking wait for that. It's been too long. The original goes into the psychedelic, spiritual side of dreams and the spice a bit more than the Denis Villeneuve version does, which is something I'm hoping Dune Part 2 has in it a lot more than the first one did. Hollywood movies tend not to go into that too much. There's also some positive messages, such as if you want something done, do it yourself. Don't rely on others, especially the government, to come to your aid in your time of need, and that you must be self-reliant. So this leads into the final act. As I mentioned before, the people can't rely on the government to come and save them from Godzilla, so the people must help themselves. The other thing that pops up about this time is self-forgiveness, especially the guys that served in the war, Koichi being the obvious one, him being the failed kamikaze pilot. He has failed his mission and his duty to his country. He has chosen to live. He is very much at odds with this. A lot of his friends on the island died where he didn't. And this is the cause of a lot of self-doubt and guilt for Koichi. And being in the post-war years, Japan wasn't allowed to rearm itself in the form of a navy or an army. They have 4 ships left, which were in the hands of the UN. They convinced the UN to give them the ships for defense of the Japanese mainland against Godzilla. But the problem was there was no one to crew the ships. The ex-naval scientist and weapons specialist comes up with a plan to defeat Godzilla by using Heron gas to counteract his buoyancy in the water. A town meeting is called and a civilian army is formed, led by a former admiral or general of the Japanese Defense Force. Can't remember which. He leads the ragtag crew. They're all made up of ex-servicemen, either army or navy, who have become lost in society or have no place, who have PTSD or other physical or mental problems related to the war. So the civilian navy is formed, they load the ships and get ready to take on Godzilla. If they don't do something, no one will, which will have disastrous consequences on future generations. The plan is to protect the future, and you can kind of insert the metaphor here. Godzilla is the metaphor for everything bad that has happened till this point. The government lying, food and job shortages, and everything else that's happened so far. I do like the messaging. A character from the start of the film is reintroduced. There's also a very strong emphasis placed on honor and duty at this point. These guys don't have to do it. They're volunteers. They've already been through one war, and now they're asked to defend the Japanese mainland once again from a gigantic monster. A lot of them don't want anything to do with the government. They just want to be left alone. But no one else in society has the skills needed to do the job. Therefore, it falls on them to protect their homeland and the future. The plan is to lure Godzilla out into the trench just off the coast of the Japanese mainland, get him caught up in cables with cylinders of Heron gas, make him sink down to the bottom of the ocean where the pressure will hopefully crush him and kill him. If that doesn't work, there's another plan to inflate him using naval inflation bags to bring him up to the surface as quickly as possible, freezing and causing pressure that will hopefully also crush him and kill him. So the ships are on the way, headed to the final attack. Koichi's in the plane, headed for Godzilla, and determined to fulfill his destiny of becoming a kamikaze pilot. There's a cool shot of Godzilla coming up on land and flattening a rural province. It's very reminiscent of some of the original Godzilla films, where he's walking through the countryside or the mountains, because we always think of Godzilla as just destroying cities. So that was cool seeing a bit of a throwback to the originals. So Koichi engages Godzilla in the rural area with his plane and leads him out to sea, in the hopes that the ships will snare Godzilla and be able to sink him. It gets surprisingly emotional from here, and not just on the human side. The humans do battle with Godzilla. I won't give too much away. The humans return to Japan as heroes and save the day, bringing an end to Godzilla Minus One. All in all, Godzilla Minus One was a human story in the midst of a monster movie. And that concludes the review part of the show. When I saw it in the theatre, there was a lot of younger people in the audience, which was good to see. There was about 20 people there. A lot more than I was expecting for a subtitled film, especially from younger people. There was a father and son in the same row as me. They were at the end. The son was probably 10 or 11, something like that. He had a drink in one cup holder and a Godzilla toy in the other. It made me smile. I thought that was pretty cool. He's brought a Godzilla toy. I was only going to bring mine. It was pretty funny. He was getting really into the film, which is good to see a younger generation getting into Godzilla and not another generation that just goes to Marvel and DC movies. He's definitely flying the Godzilla flag high for future generations. And when he left, he had his Godzilla toy in one hand and he was talking to his dad all about the films, about what he liked and what he didn't like. It was good to see. All in all, I give Godzilla Minus One 4, 4.5 out of 5. It was very enjoyable. And it had some pretty impressive visual effects, despite only costing $15 million to make. The budget for Godzilla Minus One was about the same as Sound of Freedom. And there's no special effects in that movie. And there's a lot of special effects in this. And it's kind of mind-blowing when you just see what Japanese studios can do with $15 million as opposed to Disney or Marvel and DC. The Flash cost $200 million and it has some of the worst special effects in a movie this year and probably of a superhero movie in the past 20 years. That scene with the babies falling out of the hospital was some of the worst demonstrated special effects in a very long time. The same goes for Ant-Man and the Wasp and some of the Marvel movies lately. I've stopped seeing Marvel films in the cinema because they just suck. It's probably going to piss a lot of the Marvel fans off, but I don't care. They probably should have stopped making Marvel films after Avengers Endgame. They're really scraping the bottom of the barrel for the C and D grade characters that no one gives a fuck about unless you are a hardcore Marvel nerd. And, you know, Godzilla wasn't just a special effects laden action film. It had a good message. It was well acted. You could tell the actors and the crew cared about what they were making. It wasn't just another project to work on where they got paid fuck all. There was a lot of care and love that went into the film. The visual effects are fantastic for the budget. They're not perfect. There are some scenes where the special effects look like they're from, you know, 8 years ago or so. They're not quite as polished as some of the bigger budgets. They're still on par and better than most of the special effects I've seen this year.
Hi, I'm Natasha with Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy. Embark with me on a journey to uncover the details involving cryptids, haunted houses, and unsolved mysteries. Get ready to awaken your curiosity and explore the unknown. Ask questions, and together, let's unravel the secrets behind the legends.
So this brings up the big question. Why are Hollywood films so expensive in comparison? Disney likes to make big claims that this movie cost $250 million, or it cost $280 million. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny cost $350 million. $348 million, and it made about $380 million at the box office. bearing in mind that was with reshoots and all the drama that happened with that movie. But even so, it seems like a staggering number. So either the studios are full of shit and they're lying to make it sound more impressive, you know, hope that people might go see it if it's got a huge budget. That means it has to be good, right? Much like the attraction to a lot of the theme parks, bigger is better. Disneyland's always opening new and pointless attractions to try and increase visitors to come back and spend their money. But even with reshoots and heavy special effects in a lot of these films, $350, even $250 million is a lot of fucking money. And aside from Avatar, you can't really say that that's money well spent. Because a lot of these films, like the Marvel movies and Dial of Destiny, had a lot of live action stuff with, you know, CGI backgrounds or environments or whatever. But most of the film was practically shot. Avatar, The Way of Water is a different story. There's a lot of digital backgrounds and environments, and pretty much all the characters are digital besides the humans. And even that didn't cost $350 million. Well, we don't know. It may have cost upwards of $300 million, but it was money well spent. It looks good. And the first Avatar still holds up 13 years later. Ant-Man and the Wasp and The Flash don't stand up in the year that they were released, and they're definitely not going to be standing up to special effects in 13 years' time. So where does that money go? They spend $150 million on the budget of The Dial of Destiny, and what do they get for it? Piss poor box office returns. It's not even average box office returns, it's below average. That movie had to make $800 million to break even, and it didn't even come close. The Marvels made, what, $190-something million, just under $200 million, and it cost $200-something million to make, so it's a complete catastrophic failure, and that's coming from the Marvel juggernaut. So these studios have to be cooking the books somehow. They must be overinflating budgets for tax purposes, or claiming that they had to spend $150 million on advertisements and all this other shit for insurance or tax purposes. There has to be some type of financial racket or scam going on, because if you broke down how much those films actually cost and the amount of people working on them, I doubt you'd get the same figure as the budget. Warner Brothers recently has been dragged through the federal court for deliberately buying and shelving films for tax purposes. If they buy them or don't make them, they get refunded on tax credits or something like that. That might be something I look into for a future show. If you would like me to do an episode on it, send me a message on Instagram. So hopefully Godzilla Minus One proves that you can make a big action film for a small scale budget. And hopefully it kicks off a new generation of independent special effects films that don't cost $200-300 million. Hopefully this gets independent filmmakers expanding their imaginations and bringing their visions to life without having to worry about overinflated budgets and costs through the traditional studio system. Because if you could make movies like that for $15 million, imagine how good independent films would be, especially like monster and creature related films. Because $15 million is a drop in the bucket for most of those big studios, even some of the independent studios, that's not a lot. So if you could produce that in Hollywood, I don't know if you could. There's probably a lot more going on behind the scenes that none of us are really privy to, but it would be a good start. I also watched the credits of Minus One. In the special effects part of the credits, it had Square Enix, the video game company that made Tomb Raider and Hitman. So maybe Godzilla Minus One utilized game engines and video game studios that may not have had a lot of projects on the go. Maybe they outsourced some of the visual effects to the gaming department, and that was why they were able to pull off such convincing special effects for such little cost. I'm not sure. It just seemed interesting that Square Enix was involved. So I think the main theme of this film, especially in the times we're living in, where there's corporate greed everywhere, inflation is causing havoc all over the world in fuel and food prices, everything's fucking expensive, no matter if it's a loaf of bread or a pair of shoes, everything is a total fucking ripoff these days. So I think this movie coming out at the end of the year around Christmas time, where everyone goes nuts and it's going to be a tough year for a lot of families around the world because of inflation and the greed of corporations and big business and government, this movie is the perfect metaphor. You can do a hell of a lot with a little. And I personally want more films like this. Smaller studios making high-quality films that compete with the best Hollywood blockbusters. In my opinion, this is the best action film of the year. There hasn't been a lot of action films this year. Well, I mean, there has, but they're usually always flawed in some way, whether it be effects or story or woke politics being inserted into every single action and superhero film that has been made in the last 3 to 5 years, probably even longer. Indiana Jones would have been a hell of a lot better if certain characters weren't in it, and it wasn't such a mess. And this goes back to the problems of the script and the reshoots and Kathleen Kennedy trying to control everything. The more films like Godzilla Minus One that come out, the better. There's no politics besides the ones that serve the purpose in the story. There was no woke shit. I don't think the Japanese are really into the woke shit, so there was none of that. Dare I say it? It was old-fashioned filmmaking made with modern techniques. And I think Hollywood could definitely learn a lot of lessons from this film. You don't have to have a $300 million budget to make a good action film anymore. You can use special effects creatively that serve the story. Not every scene needs thousands of special effects elements in it. You can make a very compelling, convincing, and entertaining story using a lot less. A lot of movies that I've seen this year have had a lot of special effects, and the stories haven't benefited from it. In fact, the best films I've seen this year have all had relatively low budgets and minimum special effects. Oppenheimer, Sound of Freedom, Godzilla Minus One, Killers of the Flower Moon. They've all had limited visual effects, and they're some of the best films that have been released this year. One of the things I really loved about the film was the design of Godzilla. They haven't changed the original Godzilla all that much. They've just merely made him more modernish by using CGI. Obviously, the way he moves is a lot different. I think the only thing that's really changed is the size of the spikes. They're a bit longer and a bit more jagged looking. But apart from that, the head, the arms, the massive quads, the feet and the hands, they all look pretty much the same. The face and the head looks the same as the original Godzilla, where the Hollywood version has kept the shape more or less, but changed the head to make it more square, and a few of the details like that. So digging deeper into Godzilla Minus One, I found an article on theconversation.com titled Godzilla Minus One, Finding Paradise of Shared Cooperation Through an Environmental Disaster, published the 20th of December, 2023. It's by Chris Corker. Godzilla Minus One, directed by Takahashi Yamazaki, brings viewers back to post-war Japan and to the wholly belligerent monster of the original 1954 Godzilla, a beast bereft of the friendly connotations acquired in the later Toho Studios' Japanese installments. The original Godzilla represented what its director Ishihara Honda described as the invisible fear of the nuclear contamination of our planet. Historian William Satoshi asserts in his book dedicated to the series that the film allows us to neutralize our fears of potential annihilation. Cathartic or not, this apocalyptic trend remains a staple of science fiction movies and series to this day. Minus One returns to that fear, once perhaps invisible, but now undeniable, of the disasters incurred by damage to our environment. At the same time, the film asks how individuals and communities can tackle disasters while embracing an ethos of mutual aid that sidesteps nostalgia for nationalist policies that lead to even more harm. Interesting. I didn't actually think of it like this. That's one way you could look at Godzilla, is a metaphor for the environment and how human beings are having a direct impact over our environment, whether that be man-made nuclear devices or energy, fossil fuels, mining, whatever way you want to look at it, all that has a negative effect on the planet. Whether you believe in climate change or not, I think it's pretty much undeniable at this point that humans have had a pretty detrimental impact on the environment. If Godzilla movies help get that point across, especially to a younger generation, studios should be making more Godzilla films and getting the message out there. That's a good thing, right? Because it's a gamble and an experiment that is only going to end up hurting the people that live on Earth if we get this wrong. just say it is a giant conspiracy designed to control a population? Is it worth taking the risk and not doing anything about it, even though the science is pretty firm on it? Because so far it's the government that doesn't seem to be wanting to do a hell of a lot. Some governments are implementing some ridiculous policies that only serve Big Brother and the state and companies that make these so-called products that you have to buy to save the environment, like electric cars. I'm not 100% convinced that if everyone buys an electric car, that's going to solve the problem. The problem is a lot deeper than that. It's industry, military, industrial complex, mining, shipping, aviation. These are all massive polluters. You know, your four-cylinder hatchback, your drive to work every day is going to do far less environmental damage than one Oscars party. You know, some of these celebrities, I like to complain the loudest about the environment. They take a private jet to a meeting a couple of hours away and produce a lot of CO2 and a pretty hefty carbon footprint in their private planes. Bill Gates likes to whinge about the environment, yet he's got a fleet of four or five private jets that create more pollution than several households would in an entire year. So, you know, who's the hypocrite? Don't quote me on the details, but it's something along those lines. Disaster response. In the two most recent installments in the Godzilla franchise, 2016's Shin Godzilla and 2023's Godzilla Minus One, the monster can be read as a personification of a diminished belief in governmental abilities to prevent or respond adequately to disaster. That's an interesting point. Especially in Japan, the tsunami they had 10 years ago, the government didn't respond quick enough. In lots of natural disasters around the world, governments never quite respond quickly enough. Yeah, it must be a huge logistical nightmare to get all those moving pieces in place so quickly. But that doesn't give people faith in their government if they can't get their act together in the time of need. After all, what are the taxpayer dollars going to if it's not to improve the services of communities and to buy vehicles and supplies for disasters when they're needed? The fires in Australia from a couple of years ago, millions and millions of dollars were raised, but not a lot of it has filtered down, surprisingly, to the people that actually need the money. You could donate directly to specific fire departments and charities that would get the money where it had to go. A lot of celebrities were saying, do not donate to the Red Cross because they're just going to hold on to the money and not distribute the money where it's needed. The Red Cross allegedly hoarded millions and millions of dollars of donations for the purposes of future disasters, which makes no sense, but makes some sense. It makes no sense because you have to spend the money to prevent the disasters from happening, such as buying helicopters and water bombers, better PPE for the firefighters who are risking their lives trying to battle bushfires, supplies, upgrading the infrastructure, upgrading facilities, response times, hiring people, coordinating with government, setting up new departments to handle disaster response. Yet they hoarded, I can't remember the exact figures, but it was something like $20 million. Didn't get distributed. It was held out for future disasters. Now it's great to have an account just for future disasters so you can buy supplies, but wouldn't it be smarter to already have the supplies in a warehouse or have a supply network or a supply chain already set up, ready to go in the advent of a disaster? If I had to plan or had some power in the government, that's how I would look at it. And given how long it takes to organize disaster response with supplies and vehicles and personnel already in place, it's not much of a comfort saving $20 million in an account to get supplies when they're needed. It takes long enough to get the supplies when they're already gathered to get them to the people that actually need it. There's flooding in Australia at the moment and disasters all around the world. Water was a big issue. There was only so much water left for the week, and they were having trouble getting the army to these places to get to the supplies. Now you imagine you had to buy the bottles of water with the $20 million you had in the bank account somewhere a day or 2 days after the floods already happened. So you need to find someone who can get their hands on a million bottles of water. You've got to find a supplier, a distributor, transport, and you have to get it here. So that could take a week, or it could take weeks, maybe months, if this is a COVID year with broken supply chains all around the world, that could be multiple months or even a year. Look how much the world was delayed just by microchips made in a factory in China. Everyone used the same microchips, and it halted global production on cars, consumer devices, and even PlayStations. So you imagine if you needed a million bottles of water yesterday, and you're ordering them today, given it's Christmas time, and there's already a strain on supply chains and postage services and deliveries, you might not be getting those million bottles of water until the 10th of January. And by that time, people could have died. Whereas you need water every day. If you're living in an area affected by a flood, or any disaster for that matter, that's a big fucking concern. That water's going to go rancid very quick. It's going to breed mosquitoes and disease. It's summer here, so that's a really big concern. It's a concern during winter, let alone summer. So the point I'm making is, what good is the $20 million in a bank account if you don't already have the infrastructure and supplies ready to go? You can't buy a helicopter from overseas when the bush is on fire today. So that's an interesting way to look at Godzilla Minus One, is the underpreparedness of governments to help those in need in times of disaster. Really, that's one takeaway I got from the film, is people helping people. You can't rely on the government to in your time of need. So you've got to band together as a community, pool your resources, get your personnel in place, and do things yourself. Shin Godzilla, directed by Hideaki Anno, dealt strictly with the limp government response to the 2003 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. As the threat of the monster escalates to catastrophic levels, the politicians in the film are more concerned with optics and in which boardroom they should be conducting their meetings. Talk gets you so far, action gets you all the way.
Hey everyone, this is Maria with your Creeping Me Out podcast. If you are into the paranormal, true crime, and just plain weird, you're going to want to listen to our podcast. My friend Jessica and I talk about all things weird and creepy, from the Hat Man to alien abductions to your creepy encounters. And that's where you, the listeners, come in. We are working on making more content for you for what your spooky little hearts desire, which means, you guessed it, we need your stories. You can email them to ycmopod@gmail.com. You can also find a link in our Instagram where you can leave a voice message. You can follow us on Instagram, Threads, and Twitter at YCMOpod. Thank you for listening, and stay creepy, my friends.
I remember reading or hearing somewhere, I think it was either that earthquake or the Fukushima disaster. Yeah, I think it was the 2011 earthquake. That some of the first responders to the disaster area were the Yakuza. They had the money and the resources to fly supplies and food and water to those affected before the government was even organized. Now, I think the story goes that the Yakuza originally started as a group that went down to the docks to steal shipments of rice from the American army or navy and distribute it among the people who were starving. They originally started as a way of helping those who couldn't help themselves, then turned into a different organization after that over the years. But I did remember hearing that some Yakuza boss sent helicopters with millions of dollars of supplies to affected areas before the government got there. He was there within a couple of hours because he had the access to the helicopters and the supplies. In contrast, 2023's Minus One captures ire of a nationalistic government that guided Japan into imperial campaigns in Asia, and finally to total defeat with a devastating human cost. When Godzilla arrives to further compound post-war misery, hurried survivors don't rely on the same government that has led them astray. Yeah, it's one thing I did really pick up on, is there's a lack of trust with the government. This government ordered this generation of people into a war and had no way of getting them out of it. And then they came home, they struggled to survive and got little help. And this is pretty evident in the main character of Kochi, the kamikaze pilot. He's ordered to die for his country, but he doesn't really know why. Over the course of the film, his character definitely goes through some pretty intense emotional changes. He starts to question the government more as to why they would send him to die, and realizes there was a better option. This is true for a lot of the characters in the film as well. They believe the lies the government told them during the war, but when they come back home in post-war Japan and they try to forget all this, they are no longer wanted or relevant, and they're forced to survive like everybody else. So being led astray by the government is a definite theme in this film, and this is one that happens all over the world today. Governments aren't honest with their people. They're only concerned about getting another term or getting their pensions paid for by the taxpayers. They don't really give a shit about the plight of the people. It's all about themselves and their own interests. Putting aside ideological differences, instead, as some reviews of the film have noted, they turn to a community with the power to act outside the official bodies, making use of technological skills earned through wartime experience. And that definitely comes into play with the former naval scientist and the admiral in the second half of the film. While the state lends them a few ships, citizens are otherwise left to their own devices, relying on old and decommissioned machinery. They rise to face the monster, not by developing a new weapon of destruction, but by using what is already at hand. The characters in Minus One create a shared purpose in light of their wartime experience. As Engineer Noda notes, you know, that was his name, Noda, their lives have been undervalued. This realization leads them to turn away from the government and the nationalist policies that led to the war, and to rely instead on one another. To do this, they must put aside ideological differences to achieve the common goal of stopping Godzilla. This is best illustrated by the cooperation of Koichi Shikishima, a kamikaze pilot who questions the value of his death amid imminent defeat, yet is dogged by the shame of his desertion, and an engineer, Sasaki Tachibana, who initially deems Shikishima a coward, and I butchered those names, I do apologize. These plot lines reflect contemporary interest in the local and political communities we should be forging in light of serious environmental threats. Writer Rebecca Solnit laments self-serving governmental responses to disaster, but her A Paradise Built in Hell, that must be a book, focuses on the positives that can come from disaster at the communal level. She concludes that in the enhancing social cohesion and bringing out the humanitarian in each of us, disaster reveals what else the world could be like. In short, a paradise of shared purpose and cooperation. Yeah, okay, that's an interesting and original way to look at disasters. They do bring out the best in people. Strangers help strangers, no matter their economic standing in society, religion, race, or what they look like. You do see the best of people in disasters. You also have the scumbags who loot and steal and only give a shit about themselves and their own interests and don't give a fuck about helping anybody else. But, you know, those people are everywhere. The good thing about disasters, in a way, is it makes it perfectly obvious to the good people in the community who those bad people are and where the resources should go. The key, however, is distinguishing between a benign social cohesion, like the aforementioned networks of mutual care, and a malignant one, as seen in destructive forms of nationalism and war. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Nationalism is a very destructive force. That's exactly the mentality that led Japan into war and prevented them from surrendering when they could before two nuclear weapons were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And this is nationalism you still see today. Look how many people are just so blindly patriotic. They believe everything the government says, go kill that person over there. They won't question it, they just do it because they believe their government is right. But if your government does lie and serves its own interests and uses nationalism as a weapon to get you riled up to do its dirty work for them, then you really need to ask some tough questions about the government, because it doesn't sound like it has your best interest at heart. In Godzilla Minus One, Shikishima and Tabanachi band together to save lives. Their wider group insists on a victory without the sacrifice of human life, an ethos made possible by adopting a communal view in which humans are not statistics. Interesting. I did like that part of the film. That was one of the highly emotional parts of it. Dream together or die alone. At a time of an increasingly nationalist Japanese government, that had been criticized for undermining freedom of the press, the film suggests how a nostalgic dream for a return to a time of stronger social ties and a sense of unified purpose is one easily manipulated by nationalist governments. This has been seen in a host of recent examples, including Donald Trump, Brexit, and as mentioned above, the policies of Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party. On the global scale, the rise of popularism, diplomatic spats, and outright conflict sees much of the world drawing away from their neighbours. This is happening when? To counteract the effects of climate change and the face of exponential increase in disaster, we must unite. Godzilla Minus One shows how we must rely on a fondness, even a nostalgia, for times of togetherness that do not mix with a nationalist sentiment that encourages isolationism and aggression towards others. To do so really would be to go from zero to minus one. From there is little guarantee we can recover. And here I was thinking that the movie was just about a giant monster destroying cities. Some very good points. That goes pretty deep into what Minus One is all about, especially the second half of the film where everyone bands together to stop the communal threat. And as I mentioned before, they couldn't rely on the government to give them the tools to do the job. They had to band together and do it themselves. That all comes back to the core of the human story in Minus One. And what gives this movie such heart? It's you care about the human characters, even if they don't look like me or live in the same country or even speak the same language. You care what happens to all the characters in this movie. They're all very real, very flawed people who have had a pretty rough life, and you root for them the entire time. Unlike a lot of movies like this, you just really don't care about the human characters. They get killed or squashed, and you know it doesn't affect the story at all. In this, it's the complete opposite. The humans are the core of the story, and the whole message about banding together for a communal good in spite of hardship and lack of any type of help from the government, and you know the idea of nationalism getting you into this set of circumstances in the first place, and that being the same government that doesn't give a fuck about helping these people out when they actually need it.
G'day. Don't skip. Let me interrupt the podcast that you're currently listening to with some blatant self-promotion. What do you get when you mix two Aussie mates, a splash of booze, well, more than a splash, and some microphones? You get Cheers Big Ears, hosted by myself, the Chad, and my mate, Matt, and sometimes, but more often than not now, my missus, Bobby. It's a podcast of adult beverages and not-so-adult conversation. It's not serious. Far from it. Well, except for that one episode, but that was just that one. We're available wherever you get your podcast fix. Cheers, Big Ears.
So the reviews for Godzilla Minus One have been pretty good. The BBC says Godzilla Minus One, the Japanese film that's 2023's best action blockbuster. Pretty hard to disagree with. Forbes says Godzilla Minus One, the best Godzilla movie in years. The Guardian, Godzilla Minus One, Rageful Monster is one of the best in the series. Forbes also says Godzilla Minus One is one of the 2023's greatest films, also hard to deny. Also from Forbes, Godzilla Minus One is the highest grossing Japanese film in US history. That one's not as hard to believe. There's probably not a lot of huge action movies coming out of Japan that do fantastically well in the US. Godzilla already has the built-in fan base, so that's not really that surprising. So digging deeper into the budget of Minus One, I found an article on ScreenRant.com titled Godzilla Minus One's Incredible Box Office Run Explained. The 37th movie in the Godzilla franchise, Godzilla Minus One, is ranking in at the box office, breaking records and putting Godzilla back on the map. It's by Megan Hemenway. Godzilla Minus One has earned $60.6 million worldwide, quadrupling its budget of $15 million. While it hasn't beaten Shin Godzilla's box office record in Japan, it's only $18 million behind. Godzilla Minus One is the highest grossing Japanese movie in US box office and has received critical acclaim. Toho Studios has just released the 33rd Godzilla film, Godzilla Minus One, and it has turned out to be a massive success for the company and the greater franchise due to its incredible box office run. Minus One is the 37th movie to be part of the Godzilla franchise, which first premiered in 1954. Godzilla is a kaiju franchise, we all know that, meaning that it's part of a Japanese subgenre that typically includes large monsters attacking cities or militaries. Though not all Godzilla movies have proven successful, Minus One could be the turning point for the franchise. First and foremost, Godzilla Minus One has currently earned $60.6 million worldwide, although this may not sound like much in comparison to the everyday blockbuster. And I suppose when you look at it like that, $60.6 million isn't a lot of money for an action blockbuster in this day and age, when you consider the Captain Marvel sequel, The Marvels, made $198 million, and that's considered a box office flop. It didn't even make its budget back. And a small film like this, while it quadruples its budget of $15 million, $60 million is still very successful. And you know, I hope it makes more money. I hope it gets to the $100 million mark. It'd be great to see a movie like this completely come out of nowhere and dominate the box office for 2023. Considering every blockbuster film, well, nearly every blockbuster film released this year by Hollywood has pretty much failed. Look at the giant superhero films this year that cost $200+ million that just made more than its budget. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny is a prime example. 300 and something million for the budget, and it only makes $380 million back. That's pretty piss poor when you consider how much it costs. So Minus One is definitely a success. This amount is incredible for two reasons. First, Godzilla Minus One was made on a budget of approximately $15 million. In this way, the movie quadrupled what it spent. Furthermore, Minus One is a Japanese movie with English subtitles in the United States. International movies rarely do so good in the US, making Minus One earnings notable. But they are not the only reason why Godzilla Minus One's box office is so impressive. It makes it all the more impressive when you consider what they did and how much they got out of that $15 million as opposed to Disney or Marvel or DC. They'll spend 20 times that and produce something half as good in terms of the special effects and more in the story as well. It's amazing how far they stretched $15 million, and it shows you don't need a effects budget of $100 million to make a good action film. It also brings up the further question, how much money is wasted by these massive studios? Is it all just tax write-offs and financial scams? Because a lot of money seems to be wasted in pre-production and advertising when you don't really need it. I've seen no trailers for this movie. I haven't seen so much as a poster. I took it on myself to find out if this movie was even out. I think the only advertisement I've seen of it has been on Instagram. I've seen no promos or posters. I didn't even know this film had even been made. So if they cut out the advertisement budget and they still made this much on a film that only cost $15 million, why isn't Disney and Marvel doing it? You don't need to have three or four different trailers out within a four-month span of time and overhype everything and plaster buses. If there's a Marvel movie or a DC movie coming out, fans are going to find out. And these companies just go so overboard with the amount of advertisement, or their quote-unquote advertisement budget, marketing budget, I should say. Maybe they should just put more money into making films like The Flash look better rather than trying to overhype them and over-advertise. Because that's the other thing, if you're subject to advertisement all the time, you just tend not to notice it. No matter how many times you see an ad on TV, it just goes over your head and it just becomes invisible. But if you're really interested in it, you're going to go find it. Godzilla Minus One hasn't beaten Shin Godzilla at the Japanese box office yet. Although Godzilla Minus One has impressive box office numbers, it is important to note that it has yet to beat Shin Godzilla. Shin Godzilla premiered in 2016 and was the first in the franchise's Reiwa era since its release. Shin Godzilla has maintained its place at the highest grossing Japanese produced Godzilla film in the entire franchise. It made a worldwide total of $78 million at the box office with a measly budget of $7 million. Wow, that's incredible. It's got a lot of special effects in that movie and it cost under $10 million. Disney, what the fuck are you doing? Everything you make costs $300 and it doesn't make half its money back. Even a quarter of its money back. It can't even make the production budget back. So Disney, you should definitely go have a talk with some Japanese filmmakers and find out how you can make good films on a shoestring budget. In Japan, it received significant critical acclaim. So at this point, Godzilla Minus One is a strong contender, but has not beat Shin Godzilla's achievements. However, this comparison is not meant to put down Godzilla Minus One. In fact, there is still time for the film to beat Shin Godzilla, as it has only been out for a month or so. To be specific, there is only 18 million separating the two films. Additionally, where Godzilla Minus One is now in terms of its box office is still outstanding. Even if it does not overwhelm Shin Godzilla, the fact that Godzilla Minus One has come so close to the most successful Godzilla movie in the franchise is a major accomplishment, especially since Shin Godzilla has been standing on its own for 7 years. I'm yet to see it. Godzilla Minus One is the highest grossing Japanese movie at the US box office. This is an incredible achievement, especially for a franchise that has seen so many ups and downs, as Godzilla has. Minus One has not only proven itself among its franchise and in Japan, but it has also made a name for itself in the United States and Australia and the overseas market, where competition among movies is fierce. Is it as fierce as it used to be? This year has produced a lot of duds, so I'm not surprised people are flocking to this movie. They want something original, something that was made with some heart and not just a giant corporation adding nostalgic elements and hoping they can make $1 billion out of it. To break a record such as this is the sign of great things for the future of Japanese cinema in the United States. Yeah, I'm looking forward to more Japanese films in the cinema. If they can make one or even two or three films like this a year, I'll go see them. I'd rather give my money to smaller independent films like this that are doing big things rather than giving my hard-earned dollars to fucking Disney or Marvel and have the same lackluster, mediocre shit produced 3-4 times a year with endless reboots and sequels. Minus One also broke the record for having the biggest debut for an international film in 2023. Because of this, it is no surprise that the film has been acknowledged for its achievements by being nominated for a number of awards. Interesting. In particular, Minus One received 4 nominations at the 48th Ho Chi Film Awards, with director Takashi Yamazaki winning Best Director. And the film is a finalist for Best Visual Effects at the 96 Academy Awards. And so it should be. It probably won't win. Well, actually, it might, because there's been such problems with the visual effects in films this year. It wouldn't surprise me if it did win Best Visual Effects, because it might not have the most overall polished or stylistic effects in a film this year, but it definitely has the best in terms of what it was able to do with the money. Because this doesn't look like a film from 30 years ago or 20 years ago. It looks like a film from today. And when you compare it with the best special effects in film, you look at the effects and say, well, that's only 3 or 4 years old. It's basically on par where modern effects are, if that makes any sense at all. US critics have given Godzilla Minus One particular praise for its visual effects, direction, story, characters, musical score, and social commentary. If Marvel and Disney spent less time lecturing people about social justice and trying to fill their films with a bunch of woke propaganda, maybe more people would go see them. This brings up important social issues, ones that affect everybody in a big picture sense. Disney's main concern seems to be how can they butcher classics and make endless remakes and reboots. The question remains, why has Godzilla Minus One done so good at the box office? This is an especially pertinent question considering the varying success of past Godzilla films. In all, there are many reasons why Godzilla Minus One stuck out to audiences and critics when others did not. First and foremost, Minus One brings us a new tone that the franchise has not yet explored. Not only that, the story itself is strong, which makes the overall execution of the film a success. With early reviews being so favourable, it makes sense that the audiences would be interested in checking out the next great Godzilla film. Furthermore, the fact that Godzilla Minus One is unique from more recent Godzilla films definitely helped. In the years between Minus One and Shin, Japan has produced animated Godzilla films that simply haven't connected with audiences. Meanwhile, Minus One has depicted a version of the monster that is familiar to audiences and therefore is more successful. It is a classic mix of old and new that has engaged audiences this time around. Plus, Godzilla Minus One had no competition at the box office since it was really the only movie of its kind showing at the time. And look at some of the other big films that are coming out towards the end of the year, Wonka and Aquaman 2. Just look at the shit that has gone on with Aquaman 2. I mean, it might be a good film. I hope it is. I love Jason Momoa and James Wan. But it's had reshoots. It's had drama on set with Amber Heard. It's lawsuits from Elon Musk. It's been recut 3 times because the first two had a 60% audience score, which is not very good. Where this just comes out, $15 million budget, and everyone seems to like it because it's got integrity and a good, great story. Overall, Minus One's box office success is a huge sign for the Godzilla franchise. The film has proven that Godzilla is still popular, is still a popular franchise that audiences will want to invest in. Furthermore, Minus One in particular has shown what types of stories and forms audiences are interested in when it comes to the monster. Following Godzilla Minus One's success, it will be important for the MonsterVerse to learn from Godzilla Minus One. That's very true, because the Hollywood Godzilla can't just keep churning out Kong versus Godzilla every couple of years. They're going to have to eventually do something different with the story to keep people engaged. It started off good. I did like the 2014 revival of Godzilla. It was a bit slow in places, but it was a good start. Godzilla 2, King of the Monsters, is a bit more of a straight-out action film. It's still a good movie, but that's going to wear thin eventually, just like some of the older previous Godzilla films have. And like what is happening with Marvel, they just keep making the same shit over and over and over again. So I hope there's a lot more Godzilla films to come. And I always thought Godzilla films would have been really hard to make because of the immense budget for all the destruction. And it's kind of hard to pull off a gigantic monster now without special effects. Long gone are the days of the suit. Although if someone did make a Godzilla film with a really cool suit with a performer in it, that also might be cool. That would be a bit nostalgic. It could work if it was done right. I mean, isn't that what Power Rangers did? Years later, used people in suits fighting each other with miniatures in the background. I'm sure you could pull that off a lot more convincingly these days than you could back then. That's a huge problem with Hollywood, is if you're talking about a Godzilla movie, you automatically, the movie has to be $200+ million just for the amount of effects needed. And obviously, this is not the case, because Japan can make a movie that is one of the best Godzilla films in the franchise for a fraction of the price. The company should try to replicate the magic this film had and move forward with more live-action films with strong storylines. Minus One's success is also an indicator of change for Toho's movie performance in the United States. Whatever film the company makes next, it will likely garner some sort of audience based on Minus One's success. This will act as a sort of safety net for the filmmaker. Furthermore, the franchise may seem a more important changes coming its way, including English dubs. You know, it'd be interesting, it'd be easier to read, but it might take some of the authenticity away. This would be a great sign that Toho's Godzilla films are especially popular in the United States, enough so to warrant a dub. All in all, Minus One has broken ground, and hopefully the changes will be lasting. And yeah, and I hope it's successful. I hope it makes 200, 300 million, and they make more sequels, they become more popular, they produce quality films like this every couple of years, and they get bigger theatrical releases. Give us some more options besides Disney, Marvel, DC, and whatever fucking regurgitated sequel or sequels are coming out this year. Because most films this year have been a sequel to either a well-established franchise or a legacy franchise or another superhero film.
Imagination, creativity, storytelling, brainstorming, or Brianstorming. This is the Brianstorming Project. Join me, Chad, or as I probably should go by now, Brianstorm, each week as I use my overactive imagination to brainstorm ideas. Each week I'll pick a different genre and create a story from scratch. Characters, world, premise, the whole kit and caboodle. The creative process in podcast form. This should be fun. Listen to the Brainstorming Project wherever you get your podcast fix. Join the Brainstorm.
So I've got one final review to share. It's from TheGuardian.com, titled Godzilla Minus One, a review, a thunderously entertaining prequel by Wendy Ide. A failed kamikaze pilot, one furious radioactive lizard, and a Japan devastated by war collide in Takahashi Yamazaki's unashamedly redemptive action thriller. Ever since he first lumbered on the big screen in Ashiro Honda's 1954 original film, Godzilla has been more than just a monster. The city-crunching prehistoric mega-reptile has been cast as a metaphor for the nuclear threat, American military might, and environmental abuses. It's one of my favourite aspects of Godzilla, him being a metaphor for the environment. I kind of see him as a balance when things get out of alignment. He shows up, wreaks havoc, and puts humans back in their place. He also represents a seemingly boundless franchise opportunity, having appeared in almost 40 films of widely varying quality. Of all of these, the terrific Godzilla Minus One is one of the very best. Written and directed by Takashi Yamazaki, best known for sci-fi horror films, Parasite Parts 1 and 2, and the comedy drama Always, Sunset on 3rd Street. This thunderously entertaining prequel, set in Japan in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, takes the King of Monsters back to his roots. Absolutely love that part of it. I loved seeing a nostalgic retro Godzilla set in the past rather than in the present. In this version, Godzilla takes on a fresh metaphorical significance. Here, he symbolizes the national anguish, trauma, guilt, and grief of the country's post-war period. His shape, with his squat rump, chunky thighs, and a head that seems to be all jaws and no brains, is immediately recognizable. But this version of Godzilla looks as though he was created from a still smoldering wreckage of Japan's shattered cities. There are angry embers visible through the gaps between his scales. His jagged dorsal plates look like the broken spines of bombed out buildings. He is destruction and devastation, pain and shame made flesh. Yeah, it's interesting. I never quite thought of his design like that, but I guess it makes a lot of sense when you break it down like that. The jagged plates do kind of look like broken glass or mangled metal or a building that's been destroyed. The embers under the skin when he heals could directly be a metaphor for Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Tokyo was firebombed and so were a bunch of other cities. They burnt to the ground for days and there pretty much was nothing left. Godzilla's scales and his skin is another good metaphor. I was reading somewhere that the inspiration for his scaly, bumpy hide came from keloid scars people were suffering after the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Keloid scars are those horrible, grotesque, sometimes elongated scars on the top of the skin. They stick out quite a lot. It nearly looks like someone's got like a permanent marker and run it over the skin and it's raised. Sometimes it looks like there's like a snake or something trying to push up through the skin. Google it, it's probably better than me explain it. They are pretty gross. He doesn't look like that just to make him look intimidating or cool. There is a reason behind it. And like how she mentioned, the thick thighs, because he's got monstrous quads in this film, and you have to hold up a body that big. The other standard bearer for the collective torment of the Japanese people is the film's tortured central character, Koichi Shikishimi. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the actor's name. Is a former kamikaze pilot. The fact that he survived the inglorious end of the war is a constant reminder of his failure. Not only did he abort his suicide mission, Koichi froze when he was first confronted by Godzilla in a prelude to the main body of the film. His hesitation, he fails to shoot at the creature for fear of drawing his deadly attention, indirectly cost the lives of almost the entire ground crew on the island airbase. Koichi is trapped in the moment of his ignominy and cowardice, unable to move on with his life because, it's a quote from the character, my war isn't over. And I did like that too. That was such an original character choice. A failed kamikaze pilot. I'd never seen that in a film before. And he's a very complex character. He's nearly the type of character you'd expect to see in a period war drama, because he does fail, and obviously the point of the kamikaze pilot is to die for one's country, and he can't do that, and he is very conflicted, and this comes back in varying forms throughout the film. He finds himself part of a de facto family nonetheless. Noriko, a light-fingered girl dressed in rags, moves in with him, uninvited, with a orphan baby she rescued when the child's mother was killed in an air raid. While Kochi doesn't feel worthy of marriage or love, he steps up to the responsibilities. It's to provide for Noriko and the infant Akira that Kochi takes a risky but well-paid job manning the gun of a rickety wooden mine-clearing boat working the coastal waters outside Tokyo. Before long, Kochi once again comes face to slavering jaws with his lizard nemesis, but now Godzilla, having been bathed by radiation from the first Bikini Atoll nuclear test in 1946, is an altogether more formidable creature, with the capacity to immediately regenerate from injury and to burp out a devastating heat ray. The marine encounter with this newly beefed up Godzilla is thrilling, but when the creature hauls itself from the water and lays waste to Ginza neighborhood of Tokyo, where Noriko has recently taken a desk job, the film and the monster really hit their collective stride. Yamazaki pays tribute to several shots and scenes from the original 1954 film, most notably in the dazzling sequence that opens with Noriko gazing, uncomprehending, through the window of a suburban train as the looming bulk of the monster is reflected in the glass. Elsewhere, Akira Ifukube's classic Godzilla theme, with its relentless stomping rhythm, one of the most distinctive pieces of film music ever written, is deployed to glorious effect. I did love the old music. I got a real kick out of that. It's a very iconic piece, and when you hear it in the film, it just fits perfectly. And I'm really glad they decided to use that, and they didn't try to make it sound too modern. I also noticed a couple of other little hints to previous Godzilla films, the way he destroys some buildings. There's a building he pretty much just hip and shoulders, like you'd see in the old Godzilla films, when there was a guy in a costume, and he had to destroy the model, he'd just tip and shoulder it. It looked really cool seeing Godzilla do that, even though he was computer generated in this, and the news reporters on the building having him walk straight past the building. It was a really cool nod to the originals. And you can't have a monster film without some type of reflection in glass or a character looking through the window of a vehicle and seeing this immense creature. The train scene is fucking cool. I really got a kick out of it. She's staring out the window and you see the reflection of Godzilla, and she realizes that Kochi was right all along. The ship scene too is pretty cool, when Godzilla arises for the first time in his full size. Bit of a spoiler alert. And he's chasing the mine-clearing boat. He's chasing the boat. It's just his head and spikes above the water. It is a awesome scene. It's creepy. You don't see that in a lot of the modern Godzilla movies. Godzilla's always towering over human characters, or they need to be in some type of vehicle to be on his level, or they're watching from afar. You never see human characters this up close and personal with Godzilla, unless it's Godzilla versus Kong when Watanabe goes up and touches him. That was pretty cool. But it's pretty rare to see that in a Godzilla film. The boat's moving as fast as it can, with a pissed off Godzilla a few meters behind. It's a great, intense scene. Minus One is unabashedly nationalistic and sentimental in approach, pursuing a redemption narrative in which Kochi and Japan are both offered the chance to re-enter the field of battle and regain some dignity and self-respect. It's a testament to the quality of the writing, which was top-notch in this film. A lot of Hollywood movies, especially action films, tend to get very lazy or very cliched. They go with the same shit that has worked in every other action film, and to the action direction. That this never feels as corny or as crass as you might expect. Yeah, this movie does take itself very seriously. There's some humor in it, but the backbone of the story is very dramatic and very realistic, and this goes back to what I was saying about it being a human story, not necessarily a monster movie. It's a human story playing out in the midst of a monster movie. The country has valued life far too cheaply, says one character, a line that tactfully condones Kochi's failure as a kamikaze pilot. It's a civilian-led operation that faces up to the monster's peril rather than a government or an army mission. The messaging, it's fair to say, is not subtle, but then this is a movie about a furious radioactive dinosaur thrashing the commercial center of Tokyo. Who needs subtle? Very well said. That is another big theme of the film, is questioning orders. These guys were told to die for their country without really knowing why or why the government had got them into this situation in the first place. And that's a thing that Kochi struggles with the entire film. He is a kamikaze pilot. He's failed his mission and everyone likes to remind him of that. It takes a while for him to wake up and realize he has the right to live. Another theme I got out of this film was self-forgiveness. A few of the characters go on this journey in different ways, Kochi being the main one. Also, Tachibana, the Takanabe, however you pronounce his name, the main mechanic, goes on his own personal journey as well. There's no defense from the government, which brings up the other theme of this film, people helping people. If you want something done right, you have to do it yourself. In this situation, the government can't be relied upon, so the people need to band together in order to get the job done and to protect their homes from Godzilla. And this falls down to the outcasts of society, the returned veterans from World War II. They have the skills, expertise, and know-how to launch an attack against Godzilla and defend the Japanese homeland. Godzilla also isn't exactly the most subtle of franchises. You wouldn't expect subtlety going into a Godzilla film. And there's no other perfect opportunity to make the star, or in this case, the very big, monstrous star of the film, into a walking, roaring metaphor. It covers a lot of issues. These issues don't detract from the themes and story of the film, and they're not jammed down your throat like Hollywood loves to do, as I've mentioned before. If this was a Hollywood film, the metaphors would be very obvious. The political issues would make up a good portion of the backbone of the film, and they'd be jammed down the audience's throat time and time and time again. Just because Hollywood doesn't understand that you don't have to keep reiterating the point or keep telling the audience about something for them to actually understand it. Sometimes the more subtle an issue or a theme is in a film, the more impactful it is. Case in point, Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight versus Zack Snyder's Batman versus Superman. Batman versus Superman has this grandiose political theme running through it that detracts from the action and the story. That big waffling, overdrawn speech by Lex Luthor about the Redcoats are coming it's very tedious, and it comes off very pretentious, where politics and corruption and all that type of shit is kind of more or less the backbone of The Dark Knight. The Joker is highlighting the flaws and loopholes in a already very flawed and decaying system. So in a way, you could say the Joker isn't really the bad guy of the film, the political system is. Hence why they have to use the RICO case to go after the mobsters, because they couldn't really get them on anything individually. And like the Joker points out, it's all about the money, and he's only going to burn his half. Where Batman vs Superman, it's just too blatantly obvious, and it's annoying. It detracts from the main story, the characters, Batman, Superman, all that shit, and it's fucking annoying. A lot of films do this. Zack Snyder doesn't seem to do politics in movies very well. Neither does Hollywood.
And it's true what she says at the end. Godzilla isn't exactly a franchise you'd expect subtlety from, so what's the point trying to make the themes of the film subtle when the main character definitely isn't?
Sharks of the corn? Virus shark? Cocaine shark? Sharktopus? Yeah. Those are all real movies. Join me, Steve Coates, as each week I take a comedic look at the bizarre world of sharksploitation cinema on Bucket of Chum, the Shark Movie Podcast.
All right, I think we'll leave it there for today and pick it up in the next episode. The next episode, we'll get into the history of the Godzilla franchise, as well as the mysterious true story that helped inspire Godzilla. Just before I end the show, a big shout out to Exploring with Phil. I've been talking to him on Instagram for the past couple of months. I'm hoping to have Phil on as a guest very soon. I plan to have guests on for a while. Unfortunately, with the computer setup I have at the moment, it's just not possible. I do feel a bit bad having to tell people to wait while I save to buy a new computer. 2023 was a fucking rough year. So I'm hoping that 2024 is going to go a bit more smoother, and I want to take this podcast to the next level. You can check Phil out on his YouTube channel, Exploring with Phil. He's on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. He makes some great content. If you're into exploring and the paranormal, definitely check out Phil. And if you'd like to support the Truth Tank, there's a couple of things you can do. Head on over to the Facebook and Instagram page, give it a follow and a like, share it around, download your favorite episodes on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, which I'm pretty sure is disappearing later on this year. I think the Truth Tank is still on Podbean for the moment. I switched to Spotify a few months ago. So Spotify is now the official home of the Truth Tank podcast. You can also find it on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and YouTube. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone you think might like the show. Help spread the word and get the podcast out there. Word of mouth is still a great way to spread things around. If you're enjoying the show, rate and review it. I haven't got any reviews yet, so you have my blessings to be the first to leave a review if you feel so inclined. Part 2 of Godzilla is already recorded and edited and should be out in a couple of weeks. Until then, I'm the Tank. This is the Truth. May the Truth be with you.
Running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Good evening. I am The Tank, and you are listening to the True Tank podcast. If this is your first time listening to the True Tank, a big welcome. If you're a repeat listener, welcome back. Right, this episode we're going to continue our epic look at Godzilla Minus One. Part one was the review of Godzilla Minus One. We also looked at some of the themes of the film, such as disaster response, governments lying, and people helping people. On this episode, we're going to have a look at the history behind Godzilla, as well as a mysterious true story that helped inspire the Godzilla franchise, and that is the story of Lucky Dragon number 5. It's one of those stories that if you put it in a movie, no one would believe it, because it is so over the top and unbelievable. You couldn't possibly imagine something like that actually happening in reality. If you want to find out more about the Lucky Dragon number 5, I guess you're just going to have to listen to the end. So without further ado, let's get into tonight's show. This is episode 53. This is episode 54. This is episode 55. This is episode 56. Godzilla Minus One, Part 2.